Welcome to Corporate Wayfinding, Conversations in Transformation with Dr. J.P. Gedeon.
Hey there, it's J.P. Gedeon, and thanks for joining me for this episode of Corporate Wayfinding. This is a podcast series dedicated to discussing the complexities and challenges involved in corporate and cultural transformations in today's incredibly bustling and swirling and volatile business environment. So every episode of this podcast will feature a nationally or internationally renowned leader that will share his or her insights about the current disruptive state of the marketplace and maybe what they've learned about adapting their insights into constructive and permanent transformation to get us ready for the future. And I guess maybe just a little bit of educated fortune telling, trying to understand where we are and predict the future and what it's going to look like and how we can best be ready for it. Today, I am very pleased to welcome Leanne McAleer. She is an award-winning facilitator, educator, and consultant and speaker, and she's a founding partner in an innovation and leadership consultancy called Current. She's also a director of the International Association of Innovation Professionals, which is the only association, I think, offering globally recognized certifications in innovation. Leanne has worked extensively in the innovation space in over 32 countries in both public and private sectors. She has piloted several global innovation initiatives that have, for example, delivered new approaches to brand revitalization, new methods in healthcare and patient care, new ways to address customer retention strategies, among several others. Also, she is the program director at the Center of Excellence for Innovation Leadership at the Schulich School of Business Executive Education Center. There, she has a whole team, and they are responsible for designing and delivering programs, enhancing the innovation and leadership capabilities of executives and their people coming from all around the world. Again, I am very pleased to be able to welcome Leanne. It's a treat to have her here. At this pandemic time, of course, we couldn't get together in studio, so we recorded this podcast over Zoom. So just bear with us if the sound seems a little bit tinny. In the meanwhile, just hang on and enjoy the conversation. Leanne, great to see you. Welcome.
Thank you. I am
thrilled that you've given us a little bit of time and that we'll be able to discuss some important things happening. I think one of the things we wanted to discuss specifically was around the notion of complexity, processing complexity at this crazy time and everything that is happening. And I know that innovation and complexity and all that kind of stuff is totally in your wheelhouse. So let's sort of get started. What are you noticing? Like, what's the world like around you? Do you have any stories that really kind of encapsulate what we can talk about today? And yeah, let's just go with it.
Let's go. I'm so excited about the topic because there is a tenet in for those who work in the innovation field, which is that the framing, and this is true in many different areas, but the framing of the issue, problem, or opportunity will determine both the approach you take and the effectiveness of your solution. That's not a surprise. I mean, that's something that is certainly understood by any leader almost anywhere. However, what those of us who work in innovation know is that innovation is the response, is an appropriate response to a complex problem. So when you pull back from that for a second, what do you want then in leadership and in an organization? You want a leader who understands the difference in levels of problem and then which approach and which resources to use at which level. Great. So one of the things that we've been working with a lot at Schulich and in my own innovation practice is this idea of deeply understanding different levels of problem, and it comes from the work of Brenda Zimmerman and Blueberman out of York University.
Okay.
And they have a great article. We can put a link to it at the end
absolutely.
Of this.
Yep.
I would really suggest everyone read it because it clarified for me both the challenge and some of the problems that show up and the nature of good solutions. So what they did was they work primarily in healthcare, which, as we know, is incredibly complex.
Yeah, sure.
You know, talk to me about an industry that has more layers and more intersections and, you know, in the middle of COVID, this is a good discussion to be having. However, what they did was they determined that really there were three different levels of problems or challenges that leaders faced. One is you might have a simple problem, and a simple problem is one where the answer or the response is known. It doesn't matter who does it, and it's almost like a recipe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, so for example, if you're cooking in the kitchen and you want to make a bowl of rice, there's a process and an outcome.
Sure.
Do this, do that, you're likely to get it. It's simple. In, you know, in business, a report that is that can be done on Excel without any creativity, hopefully at all, is simple. That kind of thing.
Yes.
Unless you're me, which finds it completely complicated. But
yes, once you open Excel, it's complicated.
It's complicated. I'm done. But I understand for many, that's a simple challenge. The second level of problem is a complicated problem. And the example they use is sending someone to the moon.
Right. Okay.
So what they describe is a problem that wherein analytical and critical thinking is the thinking that will get you to the best possible solution.
Right.
And that, what you need are a team of experts in the field.
Sure.
So getting a man, and once you get a man to the moon, getting other people to the moon becomes easier because the process, so it's a complicated problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it, so this is analytical, critical thinking, experts in a room. Then they talk about complex problems. And what they say is a complex problem is, for example, raising a child.
Yeah. Well, yes.
And I believe you have twins, don't you?
Well, I have three kids.
Three kids. Okay. I thought two of them were twins. I don't know why. So we have three kids. And what they say is raising a child is completely complex because you can't read yourself into solutions. You can't read yourself into good parenting. There is no what you do with one child will absolutely not work with another.
Correct.
And what you did today will not work tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And as they grow, the solutions change. So it's fluid, it's dynamic, and there is no one solution.
Right.
And so what do you need for that? Well, you need creative thinking. You need innovative thinking. You need a vast array of expertise. So you need a range of expertise, mm-hmm. and you need many different kinds of thinking to get there.
So am I right in presuming then that if you have a complicated problem, you need specialists on board. And if you have a complex problem, you need generalists on board.
You need diversity.
You're right.
Indeed, right. A few experts, but if you have only experts, you will get a complicated solution to a complex problem, and that won't work.
Correct.
Right.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Now, that stratification, that way of thinking about problems is helpful for leaders in organization and indeed for employees. Because far too often what we discover is that when a leader has a complex problem, so for example, I am struck by years ago in Ontario, the provincial challenges were big. They were interconnected, intersectionality was huge, still mm-hmm. is, all those pieces. And yet, stop the gravy train became the rallying cry for those who want simple solutions to complex problems.
Right.
And don't we all? Right?
Well, we all wish it was possible.
We all wish it was possible. It's like Mencken. To every complex problem, there is a simple solution, and
yeah,
it's wrong.
No,
right?
No.
It's wrong.
It's really not. Yes.
It's really not. So we, and if you think about organizations, how people are measured, how they're managed, it's all on short cycles of activity. And if you have a complex problem and a leader says to you, I need an answer by Friday, not likely.
And you know what? Like the Mencken thing.
Yes.
I kind of reinterpreted that as saying for every complex problem, there is an elegant solution. I believe that. But simplicity implies that it's a one-size-fits-all kind of answer.
That's
that
correct.
Is sort of like, this is the reason it's happening. And one of the things that certainly I work on with my clients all the time is an understanding of how the world is, I call it overdetermined. What I mean by that is this is happening because a whole bunch of things are coming together to make it happen. So in order to solve this problem, we have to be aware of and address that swirling complexity of what caused this, even if that solution in the end is elegant, but it won't be simple.
No, it won't be simple. And I would argue it's never going to be singular.
Right. Yes. It's multifaceted. Right?
Yep. It's going to be absolutely multifaceted, or else you're not really dealing with a complex problem.
My work in cultural transformation, executive effectiveness, and cultural change lines up harmoniously with Leanne's work in creativity, innovation, and strategy. To that end, we both agree on the notion of leadership generalists. To us, a leadership generalist is a leader who knows a lot about a lot of things. I asked Leanne what her thoughts were on how we can turn our current leadership population into grounded and transformative generalists.
Well, I see some really enlightened organizations and enlightened leaders.
Right.
People who understand the... I'll give an example. Traditionally, if you think about people who go to MBA programs.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you think, look at there's some interesting research at the Ivy Leagues in the States.
Mm-hmm.
Engineers, commercial, MBAs. So, but what's happening recently is you see this this change in trends, which is, for example, at MIT, I believe, 47% of the people who were accepted came out of the humanities.
Isn't that interesting?
And so as you look at it between, there's an upswing in the number of people who are taking business degrees, but who come from a very different background, which is brilliant.
Yes,
for us.
Is.
That's exactly what we need. So when we think about leaders, like the question is, if you're hiring, if like hires like, we're going to be, this is constant challenge, but if we're thinking about the complex problems we face, then we absolutely need people who have more experience. The more experience you have,
but
in different areas.
Doesn't today's business culture have implicit and, in my view, unfortunate messages that strictly prioritize certain ways of thinking above others, that the person with 10 years of business experience is superior, for want of a better word, than someone who came from a philosophy background and is getting
Amazing.
Their MBA. Isn't that what we kind of practice, even though it may not be what we speak?
It's what we see all the time.
Yeah.
I was, interestingly enough, if you can think of a guy who was more analytical and more hard buttoned down than Jack Welch, I don't know who it is, right? Okay. I know he's now dead, but if you're thinking about that kind of guy,
right?
This is what it is. Six Sigma. Okay. So what strikes me is that when Jack was first introduced to technology and realized that he had no idea, he immediately got a 19-year-old mentor.
Right?
Who came in once a week to help him understand. And so I think about that, and I think about the strategic planning that still gets done, and I think about the average age of people in that room, and then I think about the people who have a very different and important understanding of what's going on, and they are never asked in.
Yeah. So
right?
Do you think that this current COVID pandemic crisis is going to disrupt all that? And if so, what are you predicting?
My husband is a futurist. Not me. But I mean, you can see some things in action right now, right? I mean, you can see it right away.
Yep.
I was talking to a friend about this the other day, that when COVID, like, I was fascinated by the fact that so many organizations had been anti working at home, and their challenge was that they simply believed that people wouldn't work if they weren't over.
Yeah, it was a trust quotient issue.
It was a trust piece, which is remarkable to me. So and then of course, so here's the news: if someone works hard at work, They're working hard at home.
Oh, yes.
This has nothing to do with locale.
Yes.
And I mean, I can remember seeing people walking down the street with desktops because their organization had not given them any latitude or paid for any laptop. They had, and behind them would be someone with the monitor as they, this was the nature of the trust equation between employees and
yet the employer would demand trust from the employee
implicitly.
And so what would happen is the creation of a culture where I don't trust you, but you need to trust me. And culture is always, unfortunately, boiled down to the lower of the two denominators.
Right.
And we end up with a non-trusting culture and all the rest of the issues that we see.
It's true.
Yeah.
Do you remember there was a great book by Stephen Covey Jr.
Yes.
Called The Speed of Trust.
Yeah.
And his point was that in a fast-paced environment, if you don't trust that the ball you throw gets picked up,
that's
what we're seeing over and over again.
Right. You'll be dead in the water.
Right.
So in terms of the capacity for innovation and transformation, certainly what I'm experiencing with a lot of my clients and what I'm working through with them, and a lot of organizations I find might be struggling with this, is that they are trying to envision the future world without meaning to, because I think they're doing it completely unconsciously, in terms of similar structures and clothing, if you will, of the old world. It's almost like they're trying to push the box into the future and see how they refill it. And the challenge in terms of complex situations here is that when we look to the future, what we're saying is, from a transformation and innovation perspective, is there is no box. And the old box is no longer valid. And you have to be comfortable living in the gray and slowly compiling out of that gray answers that are fluid and yet that answer the kind of pressures you're experiencing today as you reason through to the future. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? It's almost like that's the only responsible way to lead forward at an uncertain time. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because certainly in my work, I find that a lot of executives, even incredibly seasoned, intelligent, well-meaning, put-together people, are unconsciously conceiving of the future in terms of the past.
Of course they are. How do they not?
And I guess...
How do they not? Right?
I guess, like, our challenge is that, to help them see that.
Exactly. Like, who is it that calls this the liminal space? The space between what is no longer true and what is true is completely fluid and dynamic.
Right.
And the job of leaders in the past has to make that which is fluid into a gel and then into a cement. Do you know, their job is to transform fluid. And now they have to work with it. It's really, really challenging.
Yeah, but you know, in my experience, once it turns into a cement, they start lamenting. Right? So the cement was, again, back to what you said earlier, where you said people are looking for simple answers to complex problems. And in my experience, the cement is the simple answer to a complex problem, because the corporation... It's a living thing. Like it lives, it acts, it functions. Mm-hmm. It has agency and it has effect. And once we, concretize it, well, concrete doesn't live. You know, concrete is dead.
Yeah, no,
and I think what happens is they come to experience that and then say, wait a minute, we need more fluidity and creativity and innovation. And then they put themselves in a paradox where they say, how can we be maximally creative without getting rid of any of this concrete?
Yes. So they have boxed themselves in entirely.
Right.
Right. What interests me is that there have always been examples of organizations that did that this well.
Yes.
Look at Gore-Tex.
Yes.
They have a distributed leadership, distributed decision-making. There is not tight oversight. It moves, those pieces. It's fantastic. And there's actually lots of examples. But what it means is we have to kind of give up control.
Yes.
And then you have to believe that, like, one of the things I was talking to a couple of leaders last week, And they were saying, our people are having a hard time making decisions. And I said, okay, talk to me about that. How were decisions handled before? Well, they'd come and see me.
Isn't that interesting? And now you're not there.
Now you're not there.
Yeah. Right? And you know, what's interesting about what you just said is the name of this podcast series, I'm calling it Wayfinding. Wayfinding is an ancient art, right? Where a person would get on a boat and would sail away from wherever they lived. And by listening to nature and looking at the stars and hearing the waves and feeling the currents and feeling the wind and smelling the air, they could make it across thousands of kilometers to their desired end destination. And it was, what was interesting to me about that image and what you just said is they were leading, but they were not in control. They were responding to a complex series of inputs through intuition and experience and intelligence. And so wayfinding corporately, I think, is a beautiful illustration of what we're trying to do at this time and, quite frankly, forever.
It's really interesting. The thing I always liked about the whole idea of wayfinding, I loved a map that said, beware, dragons be here. There's something that always appealed to me. And what I loved about that is people sailed into it anyway, right? Like, it's a fantastic thing. I'm just thinking about what it takes in terms of leadership. There's lots of work that's been done in the area of how you lead in complexity and how you lead in times of demand, innovation, etc. One of the things that one of the key insights out of a book called Innovative Intelligence is that to be really effective in creating the new and creating the future, you really need three different kinds of intelligence. So to speak to the point you made before, you absolutely need analytical people on your team.
Absolutely.
You need people who can take in information, synthesize it, give you good briefings, all that. You also need people who can think innovatively, which means not only creatively, but abductively, right? Give themselves some time and space to see. I want to come back to that point.
Yeah.
And thirdly, and this was the surprise for them in their in the research, this is the research of David Weiss and Claude Legrand, is that a really equal anchor was emotional intelligence.
Of course.
So, of course, we know that. But it was a surprise in all the hard literature to determine that if you're creating the new, what you're going to need is some deep understanding of what people are feeling, how they're responding, how you communicate, how you make decisions, all the things that we know. Mm-hmm. Great. So those three things. So you think about that and you wonder, and then I look at the, at how executive teams are comprised and I wonder where, you know, like, were we hired? Did we hire for innovative thinking? Did we hire for emotional intelligence? Or did we hire for just the really smartest people on the block? Which, by the way, you need. I'm not. Who is it? Mintzberg used to say, in times of predictability, you need analytical people. In times of unpredictability, no, you need smart people. In times of unpredictability, you need adaptable people.
Right.
Now, I think you need adaptable, smart people. Call me wacky, but that's where I would go with that, you know.
I would never call you that.
Adaptable and smart both, I think, are really good. But so just to say that when we think about wayfinding and we think about the nature of fluidity, we need someone who can read the charts and we need someone who can think creatively about moving and we need someone who's paying attention to how the team's doing.
Correct.
As they go through it, right?
Absolutely.
But I was thinking about this ability, this, do you want to mention why you think abductive reasoning is important?
Oh, abduction. Yeah.
Abduction.
You know, this is something you and I have talked about in the past, and it's the notion of abduction, and I'm going to link it a little bit more into what you were just saying also. There's three kinds of reasoning, and this is sort of age-old philosophy that worked its way into psychology, that worked its way into epistemology. So this is going back to the mid-1800s. Even before then, everybody talked about inductive reasoning, which is where you have a bunch of particulars and you come up with a principle, and deductive reasoning where, you know, I have a principle and I can figure out the particulars. Okay, that's fine. And that has been touted all around our culture frequently as the two types of reasoning. I think that's mostly right. Because they are really logical, they are rational, they are easy to understand. It's almost like they're simple, back to what we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. But also because our culture truly is a mathematical, reductionistic, right. Logical, yes. Rational-oriented culture. And so that resonates with how we think. Not all, obviously, as you would know, not all cultures are like us. So there are other cultures that might resonate with different types of thinking, but that really resonates with us. But there's a third kind of reasoning called abductive reasoning that started sort of in the mid-1800s with Charles Peirce. And an American philosopher, psychologist, by the way. Well, I guess it's more philosopher in the 1800s because psychology came up after. But he started investigating this incredible capacity that human beings seem to have, whereby when you live in chaos and you've got 1,000 dissociated or seemingly dissociated things coming at you like a tornado, mm-hmm. that in moments where you have taken in all of this information, giving your brain time to be silent, it processes in the back of the mind, and one day, suddenly, boom, like a bolt of lightning, an insight will hit us. And that insight, if it were true, all of this chaos suddenly makes sense. And that is the process of abductive reasoning, that abductive literally meaning carrying away. That's what abduction would mean in the original Latin. So that you're in a situation and you reason and carry something away with you as you move beyond the conundrum.
Beautiful.
And yeah. The issue about abductive reasoning is that truly it sits at the base of innovative thought, creativity, adaptability, correct. Flexibility. In addition to garnering insight and carrying it away from chaos, abductive reasoning also involves a degree of theory building, where we use our new insights and test them against reality to better determine if our grasp of reality is in line with what is actually happening. The committed capacity to sit in the truth of a situation, as well as the adaptability that comes from constant theory building, carrying away insights from chaotic, swirling situations, lies at the base of corporate creativity. I asked Leanne what her thoughts were on the link between abduction, creativity, and innovation.
I like it like a lot, because I think what we have found is that for the most part, people who are highly creative, now a highly creative meaning they come up with new and unexpected ideas or ways of doing things. That's right. It. I'm not talking about innovation, which makes those useful. I'm just right. talking about the ability to come up with that which is new. Almost invariably are not deep in a topic. They sit on top of the topic. Let me be clear. So for example, I was in Naples about
Florida or Italy?
No, Italy.
Okay.
Yep. I kind of have two stories about this, but one is about Naples where I'm a coffee hound.
Oh,
I'm
me too.
Okay. Yeah. Just, I have since I grew up in Montreal. My mother made espresso when everyone else drank Nescafe. Love coffee. So anyway, I'm in this coffee bar. It's very old, 1800s, called Gumbrino's, and the family owned. They know more about coffee than anyone I've ever met.
Yes.
Sergio was at the machine making a cup of coffee, and it's the best cup of coffee I've ever had in my life. Great. And I sit outside and I look at the shop. And I think these people know more about coffee than I think anyone I've ever met. And yet, who changed the face of coffee drinking? Howard Schultz, who had a Bachelor of Commerce, and started Starbucks. Like, if you think about that, it's hot. So being an expert in a field, it's very difficult for you to transcend that and come up.
Yeah.
Right? That yeah. piece.
If you're very deep into it like that.
If you're very deep into it. It's very interesting. So,
but Howard Schultz needed people like Sergio.
Completely. No, needed a team. He didn't do it all by himself. And
right.
he had, you know, all the things that would take. I'm kind of really interested in the idea of a wide experience, allowing you to see that which nothing else, putting together things that don't normally come together.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband was working with a group of executives, and there was Kevin Forrestal, this guy in Kitchener-Waterloo, who owned at the time a construction company.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about 5 years ago, maybe a little longer. And he took his family to Paris. And they were staying in a beautiful Airbnb. Great. And Kevin had a problem. And his problem was he had very expensive equipment that sat idle 90% of the time.
Huh.
And this is working in the back of his mind, to speak to your piece, all the time. Now he's on vacation. Very important. He's away. He's having his cafe au lait in this beautiful apartment. And he looks around and he says, okay, wait a second. These people are on vacation. They have an underutilized asset, their apartment. And here we are. What would happen if I could become the Airbnb of construction equipment? So Kevin came back. His journey is extraordinarily interesting. Mm-hmm. In terms of barriers and roadblocks, and can I say bankers and lawyers?
Yes, I think so.
Yes, and insurance.
However, can't name them, but
but I can mention the sectors. He has created a very successful company. He sold his construction company to his employees. He has a company called Dozer, which is now North America wide, and you have sitting very specialized equipment. You send it, he puts it, he takes care of it, away you go, new business model.
Isn't that excellent?
But it's excellent, but the most important thing for me is, what did it take? It took a really smart guy who talked to people all over, who went into a new experience, who gave himself some time, and then began to see connections.
Yes.
And then could, right? That piece.
Now there's one additional piece about abduction that I want to throw in too, because it relates to what we said earlier about being smart and knowledgeable also.
Yes.
Which is that one of the things that was kind of found is that you can only abduct based on the substrate of thoughts that you already have in your head.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
So that means, from a leadership psychology point of view, that the richness and complexity of the thoughts that currently move around your head matter in your capacity to abduct. And the fewer thoughts you have, the less you can abduct. So what that means is crises will last longer. Your innovative capacity is reduced. Your transformative capacity is reduced. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because with so many of my clients, I've had to really say to them, look, so-and-so, you need to read again. You need to get back to some basics, because what's happening with a lot of executives, and honestly, it's all well-meaning and unconscious, is many of them have bought into this, I call it like the Google culture, where when I need to know X, I go look it up. And because I can always go look it up, I no longer really need to know it. Because it's right there. I can always sort of look it up. And by kind of only sort of knowing it, but not really understanding it, I reduce the menu of thoughts in my head that I can later use to abduct. Doesn't that make sense? And as
time is going on,
I don't know about you, but with my clients, as time is going on, I find creative leverage, innovation, and transformative capacity actually kind of reducing.
It's so interesting. Did you see... did you watch Bill Gates, The Mind of Bill Gates, the documentary that's on Netflix?
No, I didn't see that one, but I've been watching on CNN. So tell me.
Okay. So this is what was most interesting to me. He regularly goes away to almost a cottage.
Right.
And when he travels with a bag of books.
Yeah.
He has the same bag always with about 15 books.
Yeah, but the books cycle.
Oh, they cycle. No, no, no. And he mind maps a lot.
Yeah.
And he believes in the sanctity of the pen in the book. Like me too. He marks books and he asks questions and he looks for linkages. But this is part of his leadership practice.
Absolutely.
And it is regular and it's embedded. And he's always taking in new information. So it speaks very much to what you're talking about.
Yes.
That if you keep that active, it changes everything.
And, you know, epistemologically, they have done research. And in order to have maximum memory and retention, all the centers of your brain need to fire when you're hearing somebody speak. And for some reason, what they're finding is computer-mediated anything reduces the number of centers that fire in response.
Really?
So there's something about having a physical book in your hand.
Yes.
Where you can touch it. And, you know, it's interesting because one of my rituals that I didn't notice until my kids pointed out, because that's what kids do. They just point out everything that you do, is I will open a book and I run my hand down the page and I normally actually smell it before I start reading. It's very interesting. I'd never noticed I did that. But I think that's part of me engaging with some degree of intimacy with what I'm about to do with this book so that it can really enter my mind. I can't do that on a computer screen.
No, you can't.
I can't do that on Google.
I
can't even do that when I'm reading an article on screen from a scholarly site or a corporate site. I can only do that if I have it physically in my hand.
Rob LaJoie, who is a fellow a practitioner in the area of innovation, has said that when, and this builds entirely on what you're saying, he says, by the time you get to come, first of all, he says for complexity, the only solution is going to be innovative, an innovative approach, which is going to include all the things we're talking about. But as you look at that, the thing to know is you probably don't need more information. What you need is wisdom.
Right. And you know what? Charles Peirce, and I agree with him, will say that wisdom only comes through abduction.
What's really interesting about wisdom, if you think about it is not specific.
Right.
Right? It's not like a data point. It's always contextual.
Correct.
So the wise thing to do in one situation might be very different from the wise thing to do in another, and there might be only one small difference in the two.
Right. And that's the power of abduction. The power of abduction is it's taken into account these tiny nuances, which honestly is why I use the title wayfinding, because that's exactly what wayfinding is.
I mean, I think that there is a kind of movement to create that space in people for people. I think people are really interested in it, even though very often they wouldn't be able to describe it or talk about it as we are.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I was at one of the big consulting firms and one of the big four, and it was a huge meeting. And the senior VP...
I don't think they have small meetings.
They don't. How could you, right? How could you have a small meeting?
Yeah, not possible.
Not possible. So now Zoom meetings are 10 pages.
That's right.
That aside, so the VP, the senior VP, I don't know, I think maybe it was growth, had just come back from a 21-day silent retreat. And the whole purpose of him coming back was to talk to people about the importance of just giving some time to things. Do you know? Now, that's not the same as abductive reasoning, but it creates some of the place where it can happen.
Yes.
You know, so it's very interesting because if you think about what you just said, the more experiences you have, the more people, diverse people you know, the more people you talk to, that this is all information that you need if you're going to think abductively or reason that way. But additionally, you have to give yourself the time.
Mm-hmm. As Leanne told me the story of this executive who went on a long-term silent retreat, I was reminded of an Eastern principle. In our culture, balance is considered work and play. But in Eastern cultures, balance is conceived as time on versus time off. Allowing our brains to rest through time off has been shown through longitudinal studies to increase effectiveness efficiency, productivity, integration, and creativity. I asked Leanne how this notion of balance best plays into the concept of creativity and integration in today's workplace.
Okay, so then here's the question. This is why we need a new structure and a new system for our organizations, because I can measure your activity, your keystrokes. I can measure all that. I can't measure brain off.
Right. And I can't measure wisdom.
No, and yet that's what we need.
Right.
Right? So it's a fascinating challenge. You have to create an environment where that's possible.
Well, you know, and I think what a lot of leaders do is they succumb to an emotional reality that I think plagues us all, which is when we feel like something needs to happen, we feel emotionally better if we can say that we're doing something.
That's completely right.
And the problem with that from a transformative perspective, and certainly I've seen it with a lot of my clients too, is that sometimes getting to the innovative, creative, really powerful solution sooner first starts with us not doing anything right now in order to create the space so that we can think about this a particular way. And in almost all cases where leaders have done that, they find the solution before the leaders who have kind of fallen prey to this constant activity thing, because it just makes me feel like I'm doing something, like I'm contributing. Right? So there is also a cultural message out there that the only way to contribute is to be active.
That's right.
And what we're saying is, in a world of innovation and transformation, the only way to contribute is to be active at the right point. But sometimes to get to that point, being silent matters.
It's interesting that we're having this discussion in the time of COVID.
Right.
Right. Because I am finding that I have much more space than I normally do.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, me too.
And it feels entirely different. So I was talking to one leader whose business has been decimated by this, and not because they weren't set up for success. It's they're in a physical business. It's a challenge. It's really a challenge. Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm so admiring of who she is and how and her what her approach has been, because what she said to me the other day is, you know, Leanne, this is tough, but it's freedom. That's extraordinary. She That's sees this as an opportunity to bust it open.
Like, yeah.
Right? But what a beautiful way to frame it.
Yeah, but you know what? It sounds to me like she has the X factor. And the X factor is, how come some people stand on the edge of a cliff and say, look at the beautiful possibilities,
right,
and other people stand at the edge of the cliff and just see that they can plummet, right? So what is that X factor, right? And to some degree, I think that X factor, if I can be bold and proposition a couple of, you know, thoughts, has a lot to do with a degree of leadership confidence and self-efficacy developed over time, where a leader could stand on the edge of a cliff and look at him or herself and say, I don't know what the next step is, but I know I'll figure it out. You know, and I think a lot of leaders don't, at least in my experience with so many clients I work with, and listen, I work with some, just like you, some pretty highly powered people in huge organizations and huge governments, people that you would be surprised that I'm even talking about like this, where I find that confidence of really believing that I will figure something out that's going to be great is not necessarily ingrained. And so what they start doing is they start giving over to a swirling, revolving door of activity in the hopes of finding that thing.
It's so interesting to think about this. There's two things that come to mind for me. One is the leaders I know who are approaching this with this sense of possibility, even though it's a little like John McCain in the POW camp. Like, right. Let's be clear, it's awful.
Right.
But I'm going to be okay.
Right.
Those two things are equally true, right?
Right.
That's
yes.
That piece. So in my experience, they have had either professionally and very often personally, some challenges through which they have moved and thrived and learned and built some wisdom, right? Yeah. Like, this is not their first rodeo.
Right. Yes. Right?
Either professionally or very often personally. And so that's an internal thing.
Yes.
You're right. It's an internal grit. And then there was this great article. I don't know if you saw it. I don't remember where it is. I'll have to find it. On can you teach children resilience? Did you see this?
I didn't see that one, but it's funny. I'm actually reading a book right now on social literacy, and they have a big section on the capacity to teach children resilience.
Resilience.
Is it possible?
Is it possible? And what they had, it's a controlled experiment, but what they had was it was role modeling. So they had mothers or fathers trying to do something, and they had to keep on coming at it. And the kid was like a year and a half. They had to keep on coming at it to get it, and they did. So that then the child would keep on, because they had seen that role modeling. If, on the other hand, the parent tried and then gave up, so did the kid.
Correct.
Do you know that? So there's so much at play there, but so interesting, because in the end, it's this complete understanding that it's a disaster.
Right.
And we're going to be okay. Like,
and you know, and what? This is hearkening back to what you said earlier about the three types of things that you need. You need analysis, you need innovation, and you need emotional intelligence, right? You had mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
And the work of some groups out of Harvard and Daniel Goleman, and even my own research with some of my colleagues when we've done it, what's interesting about this is they, Goleman specifically, did a bunch of research where he did assessments of leaders. And I mean, like psychometric assessments figure out who they were and how they functioned. And he figured out their strengths and he figured out their blind spots. And, you know, like, there are assessments that do that.
And there are.
Yeah, there are. I know. And they're scary. I know. And he then did an audit on the team that this leader was managing. And an audit would be almost a psychometric assessment on a corporate basis of this group, right? So a cultural audit and an operational audit. And what was interesting is he found blind spots in the group, obviously, because all groups have it. And then what he found was that the blind spots of the group mapped exactly to the blind spots of the leader.
That's
and so
scary.
What he found, therefore, the conclusion is that a leader creates the culture in his or her department, even despite themselves, and that their own character is now contagious and creates the character of the department. Mm. And so the most important parameter for innovative, transformative, creative, emotionally intelligent leadership is the leader's character. So when we talk about a leader's capacity to be confident and wise and grounded and calm and to do real sort of corporate wayfinding and to stand on the edge of a cliff and see possibilities and hold paradox, that's not a cognitive exercise. And that doesn't come through getting an MBA or just years of being in business. That comes through developing a certain type of character. And in the research that I've done, what we find is that character deals with people in the organization in such a way, with such emotional strength and innovative capacity, that they are forever prepared for the next tilt and transformation, and that they can actually look out and see possibility, because all their emotional needs are being grounded in something stable, which is the character of the leader.
That's a fantastic thing to come to. And then it's a really interesting thing, element, to say, how do we hire and how do we promote?
Right.
Right? And are we hiring and promoting for these, for built on character?
Right.
What role does character play in organizations
and how
versus
do
metrics?
It? And
how do you see it? How do you see it?
If I don't have a very good character and you have a brilliant character and I meet you, you're probably going to tick me off. So how do I hire you? Right? It's almost like the recruitment question becomes, how do we value and see character? And more importantly, didn't that whole notion of character and abduction and wayfinding, didn't that just make leadership 1,000 times more personal and intimate? It became a vocation now. It's no longer a job. It's who you are.
I mean, it's going back to the work of McPhee that leadership is art.
That's
isn't
right,
it?
Isn't it?
Right?
Isn't it?
Right? Oh my God. You remember that thin book that,
Yes. It's always the thin one that gets you, right?
Brilliant, right.
You know, my own mentor used to say, JP, leadership is a 24-hour exercise in intuitive improvisation.
Not bad. I mean, really, if I'm fascinated by this subject, because I worked with leaders at all levels, and I'll ask someone who's at a mid-level in the organization to describe the characteristics of the best leader they ever had. I could do 200 people, JP, really, and overwhelmingly, no one ever says smartest guy in the room, smartest gal in the room.
Knew how to do his job or her job better than anybody else. No,
right.
It never comes up. Ever. It,
1% of the time. And, smartest, always it's the people piece. It's the communication, the listening, the care, the emotional intelligence piece.
Yeah, right? And you know, from a transformative perspective, from a transformation perspective, in the time of COVID, linking it, what I find is when I teach transformation, you know, a lot of what I teach, much like you, like I get into the mechanics of dealing with people to create transformative environments. Mm. And a lot of the mechanics are personally challenging on the leaders, certainly. And in innovation, it'll be no different. To be an innovative leader is a personal challenge of who you are.
Completely.
And what I find is I've received many emails from a lot of former students who said to me, I heard you, I loved what you said, I tried to implement it, I got sidetracked and a little bit distracted because we have all these projects and all this work and, you know, all these things and this churn. And now that this crisis hit, man, do I wish I had now what you
that you talked about then.
Because if it's I had true. It, we could just pivot, but we're not pivoting, we're struggling, right?
It's very interesting. You know, I'm thinking about this idea of a leadership. And one of the things that we really land on is that in this environment, it is not being an innovative leader that you're looking for. What you're really looking for is someone who can lead innovation, a leader of innovation.
Could you define that a little bit more for me?
Just sure.
So, that we can
so here's what happens when you start talking about the innovative space, especially in times like this, where everything is a challenge. We need innovation. What's it going to look like? People think they have to be an innovative leader, which is first of all, they conflate creativity and innovation. So they think what that means is I have to be the gal, the guy who comes up with the big ideas and then mobilizes the team and it's all about me. And a leader of innovation is an entirely different. So you have to recognize a good idea when you see it. You have to be able to work with diverse people. You have to understand an innovation process. You know, like there's a, do you have a good understanding of what happened? That's what you're leading. Mm-hmm. You're leading a process and a practice. You are not the guy or gal.
So right off the bat, that's a character thing as well.
Completely character thing. A completely character. And, you know, the questions you then ask are things like, what's your network like across the organization? Are you interested in people? Do you know? Because silos are the death of anything new. We know right. that. So if you've been an expert in your field for the last 20 years and not moved out of it, it's unlikely you'll be a good leader of innovation because you haven't created the ecosystem mm-hmm. around you where that's possible, right?
Yeah.
But it's a character piece.
Very much so. And
yes.
certainly the people that I've worked with who have meant a lot in my life, who moved me towards a mindset of transformation and innovation, they were equally interested in the end result of what we were working on as they were in seeing me grow as I achieved that result. It's incredible how they were really focused on just getting that result without you growing this much. And I don't know how they measured it, but they had a gut feel for what that measurement was, wasn't enough for them. And what struck me is what they were doing is they were building autonomy and agency and capacity in me. So when COVID hits and we're all at home, I am equipped to be able to do it on my own.
That's right.
But there was a character to these people where they really felt that they were not the center of attention as the leader.
It's a really
everybody
big deal.
Else was the center of attention, and they were the person behind the spotlight, you know, moving it around.
And that is purely a character piece.
Right. Do you find in an innovation space, because certainly it's true in a transformation space, that those are the characters that build the greatest innovation?
Yes, because if you think about it, if you are an innovative leader, if you are the person who has to come up with the ideas, has to lead the ideas, has to do all that, you have just limited your organization terribly.
Yes.
So you're not going to be. Now, do you need creativity? Of course you do. But not, and you want a leader who understands creativity and recognizes it when they see it and can build and develop an idea with you, all those pieces. But that's very different than being the person who drives it,
right?
Like, I'm very interested. So, for example, Steve Jobs needed Steve Wozniak.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, so he had an eye, he could do a whole bunch of things, but really, if you read the cases and the research, Wozniak was the person who made it happen. Do you know?
Yeah.
So it's very interesting, right? We have to kind of move out of that.
You know, we've talked about abduction. We've talked about levels of problems. We've talked about what we need to be innovative and transformative. We've talked about leadership character. We've talked about complexity. And now we have this COVID crisis happening. So I guess the $64,000 question is, what do you think people need to do now?
What do people need to do now? I think they need to take a breath. Mm-hmm. I do. I think if we could learn, and very hard. I mean, we have people who are working at home with three kids, their husband, the same kind of productivity demands that they had before, like all those pieces. I am all over how challenging that is. However, we need to appreciate the space. Like the way the world is going to unfold, we don't know. But I can be a part of that by being in its wake. Do you know? Like by just paying attention. And what I'm trying to do personally is I'm trying to really enjoy some of the quiet, really enjoy the not knowing. It's been really challenging, but there's something incredibly freeing about it. There is freedom in this time. That's what I'd like people to better appreciate.
Isn't that, yes, that's, and how to feel it and how to cherish it.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, it's funny, one of the things that I've been doing is I put on an earbud and either put on an audiobook or music every night. And I fill my sink with warm, soapy water, and I wash dishes.
I know
that sounds so trite.
That sounds lovely.
But it gives me exactly what you're talking about. I focus in, and by the time I go to bed, I am cherishing this new freedom.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful advice you've given. Leanne, thank you for your time. I am so glad that we could do this. Could I have you back on and maybe you can help me host another time?
I'd love to. It would be great.
Magnet.
I can't thank you enough. You know, I think the hallmark of a good interaction like this is when the person who you have asked to come on learns more than the person who is hosting. So thank
flattery,
you so much,
flattery
JP.
Flattery will get you everywhere. Flattery will get you everywhere.
Very good.
Please be safe and be healthy.
You too. Thanks.
That was a conversation with the incomparable Leanne MacLear. Join me next time when my guest is Mr. Jeff Fielding, the Chief of Staff of the City of Toronto. He and I are going to talk about how this entire crisis has reshaped the city and the pressures that they are under, as well as what he thinks is the future of municipal government and how it affects each and every one of us. I'm JP Gideon. I hope you'll join me next time.
This has been Corporate Wayfinding, Conversations in Transformation with Dr. J.P. Gedeon.